an epic case of what happens when a little unofficial, perhaps, or perhaps official, but certainly uninformed meddling takes place in a region where it would behoove meddlers to dip into some history before they start getting their hands dirty. Headlines: droughts, floods, disease, mystery, pests. After a decade of increasing damage to Coca-Cola's balance sheet, that company has begun to embrace the idea of climate change as an economically disruptive force. And that is exactly what is on the table in Davos today in particular. The Koch brothers, of course, still haven't come around to reality, and they're in a position to change reality. Yesterday, City Commissioner Steve Novick, who oversees the Portland Bureau of Transportation, announced a plan to craft a new city funding source for street maintenance and related spending. So this is Steve Novick. We can expect to see something happen for a change. And a Clackamas County judge has found that the city of Lake Oswego has the right to bar the public from accessing Oswego Lake. And you recall the bell curve in any given species? When the population grows to a certain point, it begins to fall off in sudden and unexpected ways, a victim of its own success. A recent report, this one from Portland State University's Population Research Center, showed that last year, Oregon had the biggest immigration of the past 5 years, with an estimated net population of 1,000. That's a bell curve for you. Ask not for whom it tolls. Neighbors in a deep southwest community are lawyered up in an NIMBY fight that has more than one side, and it's simply when, in fact, climate collapse makes parts of the country uninhabitable and sending climate refugees flooding into Cascadia. Edward Snowden had this, among other things, to say during a Twitter Q&A, so you can get away with, not like I'm putting a quote right bang in the middle of a story, okay? Says Snowden, I think it's the best resolution for the government, the public, and myself, but it's unfortunately not possible in the face of current whistleblower protection laws, which, through a failure in law, did not cover national security contractors like myself, and others too, I might add. Thanks, Edward. Now, 3 years after working on the Fukushima cleanup, some Navy personnel say they're experiencing mysterious diseases, though I have to say that hemorrhaging and cancer are just a couple of the things that they've been experiencing. We have weather for you, and we both the alternative and the conventional. However, I'd like to get right to our guest today, because we are so fortunate to have Matthew Lee joining us today. He's been a guest on the show before. Matthew Lee is with Inner City Press. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, sure. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, so the United Nations, of course, much is coming down in Switzerland. You're in New York, and the United Nations is wading into this Syria situation a little bit late off the blocks, and Ban Ki-moon, at the helm of the UN, has not put in thus far a stellar performance. It seems, though, that in this case, it's a particularly abysmal show. How do you account for the United Nations' utter lack of ability? It's not like they've done the wrong thing.
Skills.
They haven't done anything.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's true. This was sort of a new... I cover the UN pretty closely on, you know, issues ranging from bringing cholera to Haiti to taking sides in conflicts in Africa. But this lead up to the Syria talks was really kind of a new low, in the sense that, you know, many people had said that that they were supposed to be on Wednesday. Most people thought of the number of countries invited, probably Iran should be one of them, given that it's in the region, given that it is close, made no Syria there, Mexico there. Countries that honestly don't have much to do with the conflict. I think, you know, they waited till the last second, and then Ban Ki-moon on last Sunday, convoked all of us in the press into the otherwise empty UN building and announced that he had issued an invitation to Iran. And you know, so it seemed actually like the UN had sort of waited too long, but it sort of stood up to Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and others who'd said keep Iran out unless they agreed in advance that Assad should go. But you know, even then, I felt like this might not stand. And literally in less than 24 hours, the Secretary General reversed himself completely and did it. It was almost like he didn't, on the second one, he didn't come out and announce it himself. He had his spokesman come out and read a message that he was dismayed at Iran and that they're no longer invited. But I spoke that day with the Iranian ambassador here at the UN, and he said, which I believe, their position never changed. They said throughout that they would go, they would try to be positive and constructive, as he said it, but they didn't accept preconditions to attend a meeting. And then literally having them, you know, from here via webcast and otherwise covered the meeting that took place in Montreux, there was no reason Iran couldn't have been there. It was literally just a collection of hot air. It was a day-long speeches. And it ended up, as Syria said, sort of they stacked the deck. You know what I mean? It's not, the Assad honestly doesn't have all that many allies, but if you make it nothing but a collection of countries that are against him, some of them have absolutely no really interest or in the region.
Definitely touches on a number of directions that I myself am very curious about what lies down those paths. I don't the invitation to Iran was so good that it almost seemed, well, again, too good to be true. So what I want to ask,
it should have been obvious in a way. I mean, in a sense, it should have been obvious that they should be invited.
Absolutely.
Qatar and Saudi Arabia were invited, and both of them provide weapons openly to the armed groups. So I don't think they shouldn't have been invited. I mean, I think if you're trying to make peace, you have to talk to the people that are fighting. The biggest irony here is that the quote opposition representation that went has gone and there's now in Geneva, they don't really represent the most aggressive and effective of the armed fighters, who are largely al-Qaeda affiliates, ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. Those groups aren't represented in Geneva. Even if on this now, second day or shuttle diplomacy by the U.S. Zakhar Brahimi, even if a deal were announced, it doesn't cover the groups that are actually, controlling territory and demanding that women cover their heads, etc., in Aleppo and other places in Syria.
Oh, it would be so great to see those guys. All they do their entire lives is fight. They're warriors. These are like incredibly tough hearts. Love to see them wandering the streets of
Geneva.
It's just so...
Maybe they could stop in at Davos,
Exactly.
That's where Ban Ki-moon is now. Ban Ki-moon, after his tremendous diplomat... I mean, I think what really... I've talked to a lot of ambassadors here at the UN, even ones that are pretty much against Assad in Syria, thought it was a low for the UN, because the problem with it is that it made it so obvious that Ban Ki-moon is a tool of the United States.
Absolutely. I don't want to interrupt you. I want to make sure I get this question in there.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's what has puzzled me for these many years. This is the United Nations. Obviously, we know that the hot spot in the world is going to be the Middle East. At the time that Ban Ki-moon received this ceremonial appointment, should have been very clear, that and Sub-Saharan Africa. Right. Given those facts, what background does Ban Ki-moon have which qualifies him to head up the United Nations in this particular, with the chessboard looking the way it does? It just seems to me that, he's absolutely a tool.
Comes about, and the problem is it may, after Ban Ki-moon, go the same way. It's not an open election. Basically, secretary generals are chosen by the permanent five members of the Security Council, and, Russia, China, U.S., U.K., and France. And any one of the five can veto any candidate. So you really do end up the two countries that were most, they're actually the two most powerful countries on earth, the U.S. and China. They basically both wanted to find someone that wasn't very aggressive. I think the U.S., Kofi Annan had a lot of other issues, but he did, to some degree, stand up to the U.S. on the question of Iraq. At least for one day, he said the invasion is illegal.
Just give him that.
The U.S. decided they didn't want to have the idea of this kind of superego, or that there could be this international organization that might criticize them. And so U.S. Ambassador John Bolton, he said, we wanted somebody who wouldn't wake up every morning and think he was God's gift to humanity. And they chose, South Korea is definitely a U.S. ally. So in a way, you'd say, why would China have agreed to this? But I think Ban Ki-moon gave them the right symbols. And if you look at it, he hasn't really said a lot of things about China either.
He hasn't said anything about anything.
The only thing he does is to issue these kind of canned statements of deeply concerned. It's almost a joke here. People are like, okay, deeply concerned. And it's like, I'll give you an example. I mean, okay, Syria is a very tough issue. Maybe the UN isn't strong enough to be a player. It really comes down to like the U.S. and Russia and Saudi Arabia. But look at South Sudan. This is a new nation that was born only in the last couple of years. It has some oil, but it's not sort of geostrategically all that of interest to these countries. Even there, the UN, they just brokered a ceasefire in Addis Ababa, and the negotiators were from Ethiopia, Sudan. The UN didn't even play a role, and now the ceasefire may or may not be unraveling, and the UN is not even the monitor of it. So I'm here enough that I covered. It's interesting to cover the UN because you do get to cover, like, there's the UN Secretariat, which is very weak, and then you do have, it's a meeting place for all 193 countries, you have the Security Council. But honestly, as an operational arm, the UN should shoot smaller. They've shown that they can't handle the big, you know, it's like baseball, and get their game together on countries like South Sudan. Like, do a good job there. They're doing some humanitarian work, but it's amazing that even there, diplomatically, they're excluded. Because they're inept and they take sides. They don't have, they should, it seems to me, like, even if they sometimes are going to look inept that way, they should have to be right.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And they just don't. They're willing, there's nothing. I mean, suddenly, there seems to be the only principle is what does Washington say?
I have written that down. Even if they're inept, they should at least have some principles. Thank you so much for that, Matthew. We're completely out of time for today.
Love to have you back.
It's for such a boring guy.
They could still do good work. I mean, I'm telling you, there are some good workers in the field, et cetera, but literally most of them are extremely depressed by the week's events and the guy at the top just showing that he's basically taking dictation from Washington. It's terrible.
Thanks so much for that. This has been Echoes Cadia. I've been speaking with Matthew Lee with the Inner City Press, who covers the United Nations. He's been a guest on Echoes Cadia in the past, and now will definitely be back in the future. This has been Echoes Cadia for Friday, January 24th, 2014. Sam Parrish engineered the show today. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Flashpoint celebrated author Amy Tan speaks out about her battle against Lyme disease. Also, we'll have a doctor who is an expert in Lyme disease here in the Bay Area. And the Biggs Beat is back with a candid review of the new HBO show, Looking. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Today we're continuing our multi-part series on Lyme disease. Lyme disease is a bacterial infection that you can get from a deer tick. Many people believe that you can only get Lyme disease on the East Coast, but our guests today will explain why Lyme disease is a serious concern for people living in the Bay Area and other places as well. Joining us up first is Amy Tan. Amy Tan is the celebrated author of The Joy Luck Club and more recently, The Valley of Amazement. She has been an outspoken advocate for Lyme disease ever since she was diagnosed with neurological Lyme in 2003. Ms. Tan lives in the Bay Area, where she did a lot of hiking in highly Lyme endemic areas like Mendocino, Sonoma. She also has a house in Dutchess County, New York, which she asserts that contrary to the belief by the medical community that Lyme disease can always be cured with a simple round of antibiotics, many cases of late-stage Lyme require intensive long-term treatment. Like many Lyme patients who have been battling this issue for a decade, she believes that the medical establishment needs to revise their guidelines. Well, Amy Tan, welcome to Flashpoints, and we really do appreciate you joining us after I know you've just finished a grueling tour on your incredible new book. So thanks for being with us, and welcome to Flashpoints.
Thanks.
Well, let's start here at the beginning. How did you find out about Lyme disease? I understand that you went through multiple misdiagnoses.
I was actually on my 10th doctor, and I was being worked up for MS. And I noticed that one of the tests that had been ordered was called an ELISA, and I went to on the internet to look up what that was, and I read all about Lyme disease, and I saw every one of my symptoms tests that will show what I have. I went back to the doctor, and I found out that I tested negative on that, and I said, well, I heard